Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. We balance business understanding with technology innovation and human insight. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we'll be taking a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Ian Anderson, chairman of Cicero Group and author of FUCK Business, The Business of Brexit. Ian, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, we're calling it FUCK Business, as you have on the cover of your book, because we have very sensitive ears here on Taking Stock and we don't want to offend anybody. But effectively, this is the outburst, I suppose, from the then Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, now Prime Minister, as we know, when it was put to him about businesses' concerns about where the Brexit thing was going. How did we get to that? From a senior person in the Conservative Party in the UK, who were always seen, certainly from this side of the water, as being extremely closely aligned to the interests of business.
Yeah, that's kind of the story I wanted to tell. I mean, really, centre-right parties are supposed to like wealth creators. They're supposed to like business. They're supposed to be inclined towards those that generate economic activity, that like higher GDP, not lower GDP. So I thought it was quite remarkable. And when he said it, he said nothing to apologise for it at the time. And I wrote a piece in the London Times basically saying, this is kind of beyond the pale. You know, you've got a major cabinet minister at the time, foreign secretary, saying F business, something's gone wrong. And you know what, at the time, a lot of people read the piece. It was the most read blog on the Times that week. But nobody really batted an eyelid. He didn't have to resign. If you remember, he only resigned 3 weeks later after that infamous Chequers summit when Theresa May put the latest iteration of the British deal on the table. So he didn't have to go for saying that. And in many, many ways, and what I try and unpack in the book, he didn't have to go because business and the relationship between business and voters and politicians is perhaps at the lowest point I've seen in my entire career.
It's a great book because it's a fascinating subject as to how this has evolved to this degree, and it licks along as a narrative. You have an amazing ringside seat into all of this because not only do you head up the biggest independent advocacy or lobbying group in the UK, linking business and politics, but you're a member of the Conservative Party for a long time yourself. There are various strands in this, some going back a long way, some much more recent, some related to business and its attitudes itself, some related to the actions and personalities of the politicians concerned. But you go right back in some ways to that split in the Conservative Party, the outward-looking split, the inward-looking split, the infamous Rivers of Blood speech by Enoch Powell in the 1960s.
That's, in a way, where I start this. 1968... the year I was born, Enoch Powell.
You don't look a day of it.
And I wasn't a member of the Conservative Party at that point, I hasten to add. But Enoch Powell makes this infamous speech essentially about what we'd now call freedom of movement. Big speech about immigration. Ted Heath, then Tory leader, before he was Prime Minister, sacks Enoch Powell from the Conservative front bench. And the Conservatives move into a phase where they get more pro-European than virtually any other party in the UK. It was the Conservative Party that took Britain, at the same time as Ireland, into what was then the European Economic Community. Now, Britain then has a referendum in 1975. It's the Labour Party that's opposing members of the Labour Party that are opposing membership. In fact, Labour doubled down on that about 8 years later in the general election manifesto of 1983, where they actually said Britain should come out. It was the Conservatives that were much more pro-European. It was the Conservatives under Maggie Thatcher that led the charge to create the single European market. But where it started to go wrong in terms of the relationship between the Conservative Party and Europe was probably when Jacques Delors became European Commission president. He started to develop the concept of a more social Europe, a more federal Europe. And for a lot of members of the Conservative Party, this was moving away from just being about a single market, being about an economic community and an economic area. And the concept of European Union, as it has now become, became very, very difficult for a lot of Conservatives to understand. And therefore, this distance kind of grew over time. I talk in the book about the times when the Conservatives were out of power, the long years between 1997, when Tony Blair became British Prime Minister, and when David Cameron walked back into Downing Street in 2010, when just as British businesses, as Irish businesses, were deepening their contact with a single market, were using passporting rights, as business was getting closer to Europe, the Conservative Party was getting further and further away.
I found that a fascinating period, you know, towards the end of the last century, across the year 2000, where the business community in general, large and small in the United Kingdom, were more allied to New Labour and the outward-looking pro-business views of that Labour administration. Mandelson basically saying he didn't mind people getting filthy rich, while at the same time, the beleaguered Conservative leader at the time, William Hague, took an action that really has changed history by giving Conservative Party members the right to vote in their leaders.
Well, there's a big arc of this. So from the point when William Hague became Conservative leader, he changed the dynamics of the Conservative Party. So it was just Conservative MPs that used to be able to select the leader. He changed that for the following election in 2001. So when Ian Duncan Smith ran against the guy I was trying to get elected, Kenneth Clark, all Conservative members got a vote. Now, in 2001, the split was basically about 60-40 in favour of Ian Duncan Smith. And by the end of that decade, the Conservative Party had been on such a journey in terms of its developing Euroscepticism, watching as European corporates, and when I say European corporates, I also mean British corporates, and I use the term corporate deliberately, got closer and closer and closer to Brussels for the reasons that we've just talked about, because the Lisbon agenda was making sense of the single market. So why not go after this big European market? Just as that was going on, the Conservatives continued to get more sceptical. So they doubled down on Euroscepticism by removing Ian Duncan Smith for Michael Howard. Then they elected David Cameron, who, of course, famously said the Conservatives should stop banging on about Europe. But what he did, and I talk about in the book, he added to that sense of distance between centre-right Conservatives, centre-right parties in Europe, by removing the Conservative Party from the main block in the European Parliament of centre-right parties, the European People's Party.
Of which Fine Gael is a member
of
here.
Which, yeah. Fine Gael, I talk to Fine Gael politicians when I'm here. In fact, I'm seeing Fine Gael politicians tomorrow in the midst of the current fractious nature of the negotiation. But those informal, quiet, off-table conversations, that quick drink that politicians like to have with each other to iron out differences and understand each other, that ceased to happen in the same way. Those informal links between the Conservative Party and the other EPP members just eroded.
a critical decision by Cameron under pressure, I suppose, from his Eurosceptical wing. But he was friendlier towards business. Business started drifting back to their natural allies, one would put it, the Conservatives under Cameron, but didn't realise fully how the ground had shifted in terms of the MP base that the hardliners had put in place and their pressure now on the cabinet and on senior politicians like Cameron.
So Conservative MPs were getting elected, and Conservative MPs, before they get elected, have to get selected by Conservative members. Through the early part of this century, before Cameron became leader, the kind of makeup of the Conservative Parliamentary Party, those candidates that were being selected, was just inevitably getting more and more Eurosceptic. As the corporates had hung out with Tony and Gordon and played with their government and got closer to Brussels, they got more distant from Conservative politicians. And you know, that led to this sense of them and us. And by the early part of this decade, whilst Cameron himself had said, right, we need to stop banging on about Europe, the growth of Nigel Farage's party, the growth of UKIP, was eroding Conservative support. Cameron had very famously, of course, gone for this totemic measure to show how he changed the Conservative Party around gay marriage in the UK. And that sort of social rather than economic policy led to quite a lot of socially conservative conservatives heading to join Nigel Farage's party. And so by 2012, 2013, he had a real problem. And of course, this was the point where he went into the heart of the City of London, the engine room of a large part of the British economy, the financial services industry. And he made this very famous speech at Bloomberg, committing a Conservative government, if it was to win an outright majority in a future election, to holding a Brexit, as it then became known, referendum. Of course, he didn't think he'd have to do it because he thought he'd have to be in power with the Liberals again. Remember back to that election, if you'd kind of viewed in on it, there was a sense of Milifandom. Ed Miliband was riding high on social media, looked like he was going to run David Cameron really, really close. And the sense was that the Tories might be the largest party, but they'd have to climb into bed with Nick Clegg and the Liberals again. Didn't happen. They did far too well. And Cameron woke up the morning after that 2015 election saying, oh my goodness, I've now actually got to do this referendum.
Let's move right up to that referendum. And I mean, most people, certainly in the media, you acknowledge it yourself, most people in business, most people, I suppose, in politics, expected the vote to come out in favour of Remain. But there's a fascinating insight in terms of how distanced big business had become from the feeling on the ground in many parts of the UK. Lord Rose, the former chairman, I think, of Marks & Spencer, he had become the reluctant business leader of Stronger In, that business lobby at the referendum time. And in an interview he gave about about wage trends in the event of an outcome in the referendum, he showed how distanced he had become from the ordinary person.
Well, that's right. He was in front of a UK parliamentary committee in Westminster, and he was asked whether or not leaving the European Union would be good or bad for wages. And he actually said, well, you know, if we're going to limit immigration and we're going to, he didn't say take back control, but I think we all know where that turned out in terms of the campaign slogan, then actually leaving the European Union would be quite good for ordinary people's wages. He played into Leave's hands. This was the guy who was the leader of the Remain campaign saying, and a business leader, saying that leaving would probably tighten the labour market, be better for, if you like, inherently British jobs for British people, and would probably boost average earnings. It was a gift to the
Leave
campaign.
But he also said the boosting of average earnings for British people wouldn't necessarily be a positive outcome.
Well, that's right. And, you know...
How distant from the average listener could that be?
How gilded fat cat did that sound? And, of course, you know, that's a large part of this story, that in the middle of all of this, we had a financial crisis. And this sense, certainly by the time of the Brexit referendum, this sense that the corporate elite, I keep using that word corporate elite when I'm talking to you for a reason, because this sense of corporatism, this sense of boardrooms feathering their own nest, not being affected by austerity, continuing to see pay rise exponentially and way beyond grindingly low growth in average earnings, meant that business didn't have the same license to intervene in the debate.
It showed the distance between the corporate elite, as you put it, and the feeling on the ground, but it also tapped into something that Theresa May picked up on when she became Prime Minister, that there was that gulf, that there was that inequity between what the top earners were earning and what ordinary employees were earning. She had voted for Remain. She wanted a deal from the start, but she kept herself distant from business deliberately, and business just didn't know where she was going, which has led in some ways to where we are.
Well, completely so. That first year of the Theresa May government, in retrospect, you know, I've written a very early first draft of this history, but when a more detailed version of this history gets written, Theresa May's three fundamental mistakes were this. Firstly, that she started negotiating with Europe before she started negotiating with the British Parliament. Secondly, that rather than bringing together all the economic actors, business in this case, she decided to show that she wasn't in the same kind of thrall to business that David Cameron was. So she deliberately stayed and stepped apart. In fact, I talk in the book about Paul Dreschler, someone very well known here in Ireland. He was then the president of the CBI. When he went into Downing Street, being screamed at, literally screamed at by her advisors to shut up and just not continuing to bemoan about what had happened in the referendum. And Paul tells me in his 40 years of business, he's never been spoken to like that by anybody, either at boardroom level or at shop floor level. It was extraordinary. And of course, a third massive strategic mistake, of course, was calling her election when she threw away the Conservatives' majority and ended up taking Britain into political paralysis.
You also point out that in addition to the distance, I suppose, both in attitude, in remuneration levels and all of that, that had grown between corporate Britain and the ordinary person on the ground, whatever way they were going to vote, was this reluctance by business to actively get involved in the referendum and the subsequent debate, not to be seen to overly try to influence their employees' attitudes because of what had happened in previous elections and referenda, including the Scottish independence debate.
Well, you can hear my accent.
Yeah, I can hear that soft power.
Heavily involved in the Scottish independence referendum back in 2014. And in a way, what Cameron and Osborne tried to do was use the same playbook. It was called Project Fear, was to talk about the economics to the exclusion of virtually any other conversation, not to talk about the societal benefits, not to talk about the wider benefits of European Union membership, not really to talk about the wider trade benefits, to say that the average Briton was going to be £4,500 a year worse off. Now, I mean, the figures were, of course, easily, destructible. I mean, that's what happened in the campaign. And I have an insight from one of Cameron's advisors in the book, his chief strategist and spokesman, Craig Oliver, who moved out of Number 10 during the Brexit referendum to effectively run the Remain campaign. And he tells me that George Osborne, UK Chancellor, said before the referendum even got going that business was going to be useless. Business was going to be useless, and we as the politicians were going to have to do it all ourselves. Now, my conclusion and my response in this book is that politicians have used and abused business. They have blamed business for the financial crisis, in many ways quite justifiably. But when you're pointing a finger at someone, you've also got three fingers pointing back at you. So it's the politicians that were responsible for the regulatory and the fiscal framework around what happened in 2007 and 2008. It's the politicians that allowed the regulators to let subprime let rip. They could have stopped that at any point, but the party was still going. People were enjoying the punch bowl, and, well, business naturally feels very, very bruised about the fact that the finger only points in one direction.
We have been focusing, I suppose, on what you call the corporate elite, the executive leadership teams, the boards of the larger companies in Britain, the city and financial interests. But to what degree are we ignoring the fact that a lot of smaller businesses, the owners of smaller businesses across the United Kingdom, perhaps reflected the geographic vote and many voted to leave?
Yeah, so the polling on this is quite interesting. In that, yes, broadly speaking, larger businesses, global businesses, those that access the European passports on a daily basis, people who kind of, a lot of people listening to this show regularly go to Dublin Airport to land in Heathrow or Brussels or whatever. That's not most people, and that's not most SMEs. So, yes, larger business was significantly more in favour of staying in. But even in surveys done by the Federation of Small Businesses in the UK back in 2016, a smaller majority of smaller businesses wanted to stay. Now, the argument that was made during the referendum was that, well, small businesses don't have the same supply chain problems. What is now coming home to be understood is that even the corner shop that gets its toothpaste or its nappies or whatever it is from a supplier, that supplier gets stuff from Bidco. And when I talk to British government ministers right now, they're pretty sanguine that larger companies, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, have got their investors satisfied, have got their regulator satisfied. When I talk to UK government ministers now, they're most concerned about what might happen to the SME sector.
You still have that ringside seat. You still run a big business yourself in the UK. What do you think is going to happen?
There is the bones of some sort of deal here. I kind of just wish the UK government had got out of the traps much, much earlier in the summer with its preferences. So there is the possibility of doing a deal here, but I really don't want to give listeners the sense, any sense in any way, that the UK is about to change its mind.
And finally, whatever way it goes, whether a deal is ultimately hammered out in the next 20 days or as part of an extension, or Britain crashes out without a deal and we either have Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn as the next Prime Minister, how long is it going to take to nourish the natural relationship that should be there between business and government of whatever hue?
So I'm a natural optimist. I am a glasses half full kind of person. I've seen so many political cycles now that, I could almost literally recite them backwards. When we get beyond this, we will get beyond this. When we get beyond this, preferably with a deal, and with a deal, I think we can move into a future trading relationship conversation really quickly. Politicians are politicians, and business people are business people. They are inherently practical and pragmatic. That's why they get into positions of influence. So if we can get a deal, I'm quite optimistic. If we can't get a deal, then I think there is going to be a period of standoffishness that is going to be incredibly difficult. What I do want to see, and kind of where I end the book, is I've got a real desire to try and iron out the vagaries of the dialogue between business and politicians. It's still far too much about who you know, when you know them, whether or not the politician wants to make an eye-catching announcement, wants to put on a hard hat or high-vis jacket and head out to a new building that's being constructed. Now, that's fine, but it's a synthetic photo opportunity. We need to move to a place where there's a much more substantive and ongoing dialogue between our politicians and our business leaders.
That scenario, of course, wouldn't happen in Ireland at all. It's a fascinating subject. Ian Anderson, chairman of the Cicero Group and author of FUCK Business, The Business of Brexit. Ian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by Kieran Maguire from priceoffootball.com and lecturer in football finance at the University of Liverpool. Kieran, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Now, there's no Premier League football this weekend because of the international break, but nonetheless, an interesting week off the pitch in terms of the ongoing debate about the structures and financial future of the Premier League and football at that top level in the UK. An interesting appointment as the new chief executive of the Premier League, David Pemsel, from a publishing background, which we might touch on in a few minutes and see what he might bring to the party in terms of the debate. But firstly, Jeremy Corbyn, Labour Party leader, has entered the debate about who should own football clubs and what participation supporters should have.
Yes, he's waded in with some populist claims, and the focus of his anger and target was Mike Ashley. I mean, Mike Ashley's low hanging fruit when it comes to the pantomime villains of the Premier League, and I think Corbyn described him as a bad owner. Was inferring that should a Labour Party get into power, there would be the opportunity for fans to buy up to 10% of clubs when there's a change of ownership, and also for fans to be able to appoint directors onto the board. So those were the sort of the main tenets, as well as extracting more money from the Premier League for grassroots football, whilst conveniently forgetting it's the fact that central and local government cutbacks under both his and the present regime, which have led to the state of park football in England and Scotland and Wales being so poor at present.
Given the corporate ownership of the Premier League, as we now know, Kieran, is this anything more than a populist kite-flying exercise on the part of Corbyn? Or is he tapping into some deep-rooted dissatisfaction amongst real supporters, even amongst the biggest clubs?
I think it depends upon the club you're talking about. If you talk to a Chelsea fan about Roman Abramovich, if you talk to a Manchester City fan about Sheikh Mansour, if you talk to a Brighton fan about Tony Bloom, you will get nothing but praise for the owners and the huge sums that they've invested. I think that those fans who are unhappy happen to just correlate with clubs who haven't been winning trophies. So in the case of Newcastle, they've been relegated relegated twice under Mike Ashley. If you talk to Manchester United fans, they will focus upon the Glazers and the £800 million in interest that's been paid to banks since the Glazers took over in 2005. But that anger has been amplified in recent years due to poor performances on the pitch. And I think that's the greatest correlation that we're seeing today.
So from your point of view, no sustained movement from the fan base right across the Premier League to look at, say, the German model. I experienced it myself recently. I was at a Hamburg, a second division game in Germany, where there were 47,000 Hamburg fans there at a second division game. You could see the bond between the team and the club and the supporters and the city. That 50+1 rule in top German football, that corporate interests can't own more than 49%. No sustained movement across the UK fan base to look at that model, to try and reverse things, as Corbyn, I suppose, is suggesting.
I mean, I agree with you that the German model is absolutely fantastic. That was introduced by the German FA to protect clubs many years ago. But I think for that to take place in the UK, is there a willingness? I think there is from the idealistic fans. There is from a number of fans with sort of more socialist or progressive liberal viewpoints. But there's certainly going to would be this would cause huge ramifications in terms of how is that going to be funded. What is going to be the impact in terms of overseas ownership? Because if you take a look at Manchester United are registered in the Cayman Islands and their shares are traded in New York. Now, who exactly or what exactly is Manchester United? Because there's actually about 15 different companies that are involved. So I think once you start to unpick the headlines, to actually apply this to the English Premier League is impossible. It would make Brexit look like a walk in the park.
Picking up on the existing current corporate model, if we can call it that, for Premier League football in the UK, and picking up on the point you make that you ask different fans, depending on success on the field, they may have different views about whether it works for them or not. Let's look at those two Lancashire giants in the old geography, Manchester United and Liverpool, actually going to play the next time Premier League football resumes. Both in the new dispensation acquired by American owners. And yet it seems, broadly speaking, that the fans in Liverpool and the fans in Manchester on the red side seem to have different attitudes to those owners.
I think at present that is very much the case. If you rewind 2 or 3 years, Liverpool fans were not over enamored with FSG. Remember, Liverpool still haven't won the Premier League. They only scraped into the Champions League in fourth position in 2018. And that season, Manchester United finished second under Mourinho, and they won the Europa League as well. So there has been a very much a switch, certainly since the retirement of Sir Alex at Old Trafford. The anger directed towards the Glazer family has accelerated, it has expanded, and clearly the success that Liverpool had in winning the Champions League this season, and I work in Liverpool, I saw the impact it had on the city at the time, has been phenomenal. But if you dig deeper, Liverpool lost quite a few games in last year's Champions League campaign. The defeat of Barcelona was a night to remember for the rest of your life if you are a Liverpool fan. But if they'd lost that match and they'd finished second, I think the attitude of the fans would have not as been as positive. If you take a look at the amount of money being spent, Manchester United are still spending more money on wages. Manchester United are still generating more in revenue. Manchester United are still spending more money when it comes to transfers. What they're not doing is spending the money well. And I think that's, you know, the Glazers are a very easy target, but ultimately you've got You've got a scouting network, you've got a management team who are making the decisions in terms of who the club is recruiting, and the Glazers are effectively just rubber stamping. They will admit they've got no knowledge of football whatsoever, so therefore they're reliant upon the team. Where Liverpool have done so well is to recruit the right players and the right manager.
Yeah, and you mentioned the £800 million pounds or so spent in interest payments since the Glazers effectively loaded the club with huge debts when they initially bought it back in 2005. And yet when you look at the balance sheet now, they have got that debt down to just over £200 million pounds, which is very carryable by a club of its size. And as you say, they've spent £80 million pounds net on buying players in the transfer window this summer. It's down to literally the management and the performance of the team on the field as to how supporters feel bonded to the club.
Very much so. And if you'd spoken to United fans after the first match of the season, they'd just beaten Chelsea 4-0. Daniel James looked good. Aaron Wan-Bissaka looked good. Harry Maguire's England centre-half. You know, all was rosy in the garden. And then almost immediately, the wheels started to fall off. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been backed by the Glazers. Mourinho was backed by the Glazers. Louis van Gaal was backed by the Glazers. But ultimately, we're all, and whether you can expand this beyond football, we are all where we are based on the quality of the decisions that we make in life. And when it comes to Manchester United and recruitment decisions, those have been poor. Now, is it because they've chosen the wrong players? Is it because there are inadequacies in terms of the training and the coaching and the monitoring? Or is it that Manchester United intimidates certain players because of its history and heritage and all that goes with it, and players haven't been able to perform to their utmost ability? You contrast that with what's happened at Liverpool. And yes, Liverpool have spent big, but they've spent very strategically. Jurgen Klopp identified the weaknesses in the spine of the side. He got a new goalkeeper, he got a new centre-half, and he had three decent strikers to begin with. And they just needed tweaking. If you look at Manchester United and from a non-financial position and say, well, where do Manchester United need to strengthen? You could quite easily get rid of seven or eight of those players who started the match against Newcastle. Whereas with Liverpool, you're thinking, well, perhaps they need to strengthen just one or two positions. So I do think whilst the Glazers are the target, and if you're following social media, Glazers out was trending here on Sunday. They've given Ole the checkbook, and he's not used it well.
And I suppose conversely, Fenway Sports Management, the owners of Liverpool, owners of the Red Sox and Boston as well, of course, who are seen to be closer culturally in terms of the city and what it means to supporters, they've made some awkward moves, including trying to appropriate the brand Liverpool for the club commercially recently when they were told to get off the train.
That very much so. And that, I can assure you, went down very badly in the city. I think they've done well to appoint Peter Moores as the CEO. You know, Peter Moores is a local. He is a Red himself. He does understand that. But that the issue in terms of trying to take propriety of the name of Liverpool was a very clumsy move. It has alienated some of the hardcore Liverpool fan base. And remember, this isn't a criticism of either club. Liverpool and Manchester United both could sell out and more each week. They do have large transient fans, tourist fans, whatever you want to call them. And those people don't care because they will buy any piece of tat from the stall, from the megastore and so on. But I think those people who are hardcore, who have been at Anfield and Old Trafford for 30 or 40 years through thick and thin, I think they feel quite angry because they feel that the club is now trying to manipulate the success in recent months and just over the last sort of 12 to 18 month period for financial gain. And that's caused a lot of bad feeling.
Picking up on that point, Kieran, I suppose the top Premier League clubs are global brands now, attracting their commercial and supporter revenue from every part of the globe as much as from the city in which they're located. Given that that's unlikely to change regardless of Jeremy Corbyn's efforts, Where do you see the future of the Premier League? Do you see the top clubs, perhaps, as has been mooted, taking off on their own and joining with other clubs across Europe? Will that pressure continue? And where does the new chief executive of the Premier League, David Pemsel, come into all of this?
Well, I think that the Premier League clubs have just negotiated for themselves a pay rise, or rather the elite clubs have, because they've changed the formula for the distribution of the overseas income. Now, remember, they've already got far greater revenues than the likes of Bournemouth and Palace and Brighton and so on. But they want more and more. So they've got that. I think that the next battle is going to be, are they going to set up this European Super League? I think that's unlikely. My understanding is that they want to play more games, and they want to be guaranteed to be able to play more games. And the way that that would be achieved is through changes to the Champions League. So one of the proposals is to move from 8 groups of 4 to 4 groups of 8. So therefore, all of a sudden, you're guaranteed a minimum of 14 games in the group stages of the Champions League. Plus, there could be a potentially a further 7 if you get to the final. And that would please the owners, because the owners know that they can sell out these matches every week. And they also know that those fans who come to Manchester and Liverpool at weekends spend more money in the club shop and are willing to pay more money for tickets than midweek. So they'll want some of the matches from the Champions League moved from midweek to weekends. But can that be accommodated in a Premier League of 20 clubs? Can that be accommodated in an English football environment in which we've got 2 cup competitions? The answer is no. If you do the maths, 38 Premier League games, 21 Champions League games, potentially half a dozen in the FA Cup, 4 or 5 in the Caribou Cup, or whatever we call it these days. So we're looking there potentially close on 70 games before you have your pre-match friendlies. And remember, the commercial departments, they're keen to extract as many air miles out of the players and as many matches as possible. And that's before you also include international. So potentially we could be looking at players being expected to play 80 games a season. That's not feasible. So what's going to have to go? Well, the low-hanging fruit there would be the League Cup, because the big clubs don't care about it. And whilst it's a payday for the likes of Rochdale when they went to Old Trafford last week, the big clubs aren't interested in the welfare of the smaller clubs. And there could be pressure on the other Premier League clubs to reduce its size from 20 to 18 or 20 to 16, because Manchester United aren't interested in playing Brighton, Crystal Palace, Bournemouth or Watford. They want to play more international matches. So I think that's where the battle is going to be fought. I think the new CEO, Pemsel, is going to have a hard job. Richard Scudamore, he was unpopular with fans. I felt as an outsider, he did a very good job in keeping 20 huge egos relatively together over a long period of time, and he certainly delivered in terms of money for them. So as far as Mr. Pemsel coming in, his background is in media and media rights, and that's where the future of the Premier League very much they see themselves in terms of growth. And I think that will be a challenge for him in terms of, have we reached peak? Have we reached peak rights in the particular broadcast mediums that we have at present? And if not, where is the growth going to lie?
Okay, Kieran, we'll leave it there. It sounds like there is far less chance of reversing the uber commercial trends that have beset the Premier League than there is even Jeremy Corbyn entering number 10 anytime soon. That's Kieran McGuire from priceoffootball.com and lecturer in football finance at University of Liverpool. Kieran, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Vincent.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by John Fardy, presenter of Screen Time here on News Talk. John, you're very welcome. Thanks
Hi,
for joining
Vincent.
Us.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, today we're talking about this.
The big news is actually Apple TV Plus. They're going to launch it on November the 1st, which is before the Disney service, which was announced to launch around Thanksgiving. They're making a huge commitment in content.
New details, you know, weighing a possible price, unveiling of the service in November, and Apple spending $6 billion on original content compared to Netflix, which is $14 billion.
It's an important day for the company, without a doubt. Again, we don't want to make light of the fact that Disney still generates an enormous amount of revenue and profit from theme parks and from filmed entertainment, but this is a very important day. I mean, this is an imperative for the company. And the disruption that we've been talking about now for years is permanent.
Disney Plus, that is launching November 12th, will be competing with Netflix. And now the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Disney is banning Netflix ads from across its TV networks. This comes as both Disney and Netflix spend, you know, tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars in marketing to try to draw people to their new subscription services.
YouTube TV hikes prices, David, from $38 to $55. So pricing, I mean, you could argue they're going into a period where consumers are getting conditioned to pay more.
How many subscriptions can one family really afford, and do they really want to pursue if they have a Netflix or a Hulu, and they have one of these over-the-top products? Where does it sort of end, or where, at what point does it get closer to what they're already paying or were paying for the bundle when they were connected, if they aren't any longer?
U.S. news journalists, newscasts, and commentators there, John, talking about the explosion in streamed TV and video that we're about to witness. Even an old fella like me has got used to the streaming revolution through Netflix. But the world is about to change from the 1st of November, isn't it?
Yeah, big time. I mean, I guess the two most significant things are Apple entering this space and Disney ramping up. And you see, Disney is so interesting because Apple are new to this, right? Apple had a launch and they, you know, brought Jennifer Aniston out on stage and Steven Spielberg was involved, and there's 9 confirmed shows. Jennifer Aniston, Steven Spielberg, Oprah Winfrey, these are serious people. She's going to do a book club thing. But they're starting from the ground up. They've hatfuls of cash, but they don't really have a skin in the game. Disney, you know, have the biggest movie of the year in Avengers Endgame, have 4, I think, of the other of the biggest movies of the year with various superhero movies. They own the Star Wars business. So currently, The Force Awakens is on Netflix. That's not going to be available in a year's time because Disney, as you heard there, aside from pulling their ads, are obviously going to start pulling their content. So things are about to get really, I won't say nasty, but heated. And the thing is, you might say, oh, well, look, this is going to be great for the consumer. All these people are going to be making all this great content. They're going to be streaming it. We'll all get to see it. But we're going to have to pay for it.
A huge corporate war has already started to capture the eyeballs, not only of American viewers, but literally of global viewers, anybody with connection to the internet, mobile or not. What is ultimately going to win this war, John, in terms of attracting those consumers? Is it going to be the quality of the content, or is it going to be price? Apple are launching at what, $5?
$5
per month. Disney, $7. Netflix at the moment costing €13 or €11.
€10.99, yeah. So, well, that's a really good question. Price obviously will be part of it because it always is. But I think what they all need is a kind of Breaking Bad, as in they need a show that's going to get word of mouth. It's not as simple as we've seen of hiring in people who have skin in the game and form in the game and just saying, make us a great show. It doesn't work like that. Not to give you a history lesson, but I will, said he. Netflix were basically, you know, regurgitating other people's content. They were, you know, cannibalizing it to a certain extent. They were taking it, paying a fee, and then charging us for the rest.
Kind of a simple platform.
Yeah, exactly. And then they realized in order to compete that they'd have to make their own content. And a lot of their own content wasn't very good, but it was only when they started doing things like Breaking Bad and House of Cards. And Breaking Bad wasn't this massive smash, but it was a word of mouth thing. So I think content is key, and they haven't been that successful with their movies. There's been one or two good ones, and actually this weekend the Breaking Bad movie, quite tellingly, is now on Netflix. But a lot of the movies have been god awful. There's one at the moment called Falling in Love, INN, not to deviate into screen time territory, but it's one of the worst films I've ever seen. They make a lot of bad movies, but they're getting better at that. But they make great TV serials, and I think that's going to be key. So you have Apple, who've taken M. Night Shyamalan, who gave us the 6 60% and stuff like that. And he's talking about a 60 arc episode. Now, they've only committed Apple to one. So that's the type of thing they're going to have to do. But there's no guarantee that M. Night Shyamalan is going to make another Breaking Bad. So they have to prioritize content.
Let's strip it down a little bit, because apart from content, which, as you say, ultimately will be king as to who wins this, Apple have other rationales involved. Yeah. I mean, they're pitching the price pretty low, but they're basically part of their rationale, their model is the same as they did when they launched Apple Music. It's to get them to use their devices. So exactly. Anybody who buys a new device, an iPod, an iPhone, or whatever, will get a year's free subscription to this.
Exactly, which is significant enough. Like, if someone told you back in the day you'd get Netflix for a year for free, like, that's a thing to sign up to, I would suggest. And you know this better than I do, but the iPhone was the result, in essence, of why Apple were the first company who made $1 trillion. So devices are still huge for them. So is it they want to provide a service or they want to provide a product? I think they still want to provide a product more than they do a service. And they realize a way of selling products is to give them supposedly great TV straight to that device.
Disney, unashamedly, is going to go on the content side while being competitive on price as well. A huge back catalogue.
Huge.
But also the underlying rationale for their $70 billion acquisition of Fox during the summer, which gets them The Simpsons, gets them early Star Wars, all of that.
And the thing is, what it's going to be is, you know, as I say at the moment, you can watch all sorts of things in all sorts of places, but people are going to circle the wagons. So suddenly The Simpsons won't be a free-for-all the way it has traditionally been. You will have to go to Disney to get it, you know. Same with something like The Sopranos, another player in this. Now, we're not sure how this is going to translate to Europe and Ireland specifically, but AT&T, who own Warner Media, and also HBO, that's going to be a huge player as well. So,
and they're planning to launch next year, I think.
Yeah, and they own Friends, right, because they own Warner Media. Now, Netflix have resubscribed with them, so to speak. I'm using that term subscription because it's on everyone's mind. But they've bought the rights for another year for Friends to stream on Netflix, which has been huge for them. Like, who knew that Friends, even all these years later, was going to be one of the driving forces for people buying Netflix? But as of next year, sometime in 2020, they're not going to give it to Netflix. They're going to take it to AT&T. So as I say, you're going to see a kind of a circling of the wagons. This is our content. And you heard in the clip there, ads are going to be stopped on Disney for Netflix and stuff like that.
What is this likely to mean for Netflix, which, you know, has established itself as the dominant, in fact, the only real player in the market outside the United States in many ways?
Yeah.
They, as you say, they've learned that content is king. Yeah. They're spending $12 or $13 billion this year on original content, which is giving them huge financial challenges.
Yeah.
But the news earlier this year that these two giants were going to launch in November, their share price has fallen by a third since then. Obviously, a question mark over their survival in the long term, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I was nearly going to ask you about that. Is it that tragic? Like, because they were meant to hit 5 million new subscribers this year. I think it was about half of that. But is there still not enough cake in the press to justify it? I mean, their share price has dropped, but it's dropped to something that any average PLC would be delighted to have, right?
Well, I thought I was doing the interview here.
Sorry,
seeing
yes,
as you ask,
yes.
I mean, I suppose the American market is still the key market. For the first time this year, they saw their new American subscribers begin to fall, and obviously that will be threatened further by what's going
Big
to happen
time.
In November. I suppose it will come down, as you said at the start, to the quality of their content, and can they afford to continue investing $12 to $13 billion per year to compete with what the likes of Disney will have out there?
But they're going to have to, because the only way Netflix is going to survive is to continue giving us House of Cards and Breaking Bad, and, you know, there's a whole list of shows. There's currently one that people are raving about called Unbelievable, all about this case, about a rape case. And so and it's quite telling that it's about that, because it's embracing all sorts of content, every shade and stripe. There's cookery shows on it. Like, they're pitching this so incredibly wide. So, you know, they're masters at this in a way, though. I mean, this was a platform that didn't manufacture its own original content 10 years ago. And now people are saying they should be included in the Oscars. So I think we might be calling The Sun Setting on Netflix slightly too early. I mean,
Martin, as somebody who's got used to watching it, I hope you're right.
Absolutely. But I mean, Martin Scorsese, for instance, right? The godfather of modern cinema or whatever. His new movie, The Irishman, is going to get a tiny theatrical release and is going straight to Netflix after that. I mean, that's inconceivable 10 years ago. So as I say, I think there's still a lot of distance to run on this.
What does this actually mean for the consumer? Because the capitalist model generally means that when there's more competition in the market, price comes down.
Mm.
Actually, you know, it looks like certainly for the first couple of years, if you want to see all this stuff, you're going to have to pay an awful lot more.
Yeah, and it's problematic. If you take most people, certainly that I know in this country, everyone nearly has a Netflix subscription. A lot of people have Spotify. Now, I know that's music and stuff. One or two people have Amazon Prime subscription, which we haven't even mentioned. They're also a player in this game. The thoughts of getting Apple TV, if you don't have a new Apple device as well, adding $5 or $6. And let's not forget, they get you in the door. These prices tend to go up after a year. So the idea that you could be looking at 50 quid a month in your entertainment services is a lot. So I don't know, is the fear of missing out going to drive you to spend that much? I don't know. It's problematic. That said, I always quote Orson Welles, who said, "I hate TV nearly as much as I hate peanuts, but I can't stop eating peanuts."
And finally, what in your view does this mean for conventional broadcasters, the likes of the BBC, the likes of RTE, even more pressure on them in terms of their resources, in terms of the content they can get access to, and in terms of their consumer eyeballs gone somewhere else?
Absolutely. I mean, it's deeply problematic. And we know all that's going on with, you know, public funded broadcasting and all that. It's deeply problematic. The things that they have going for it, though, is that occasionally, and I may be wrong here, but people still need company. As in, there can be a lonely feeling when you're constantly streaming, that you're just watching these box sets all the time. So the idea that you tune in for news or that you tune in for live chat shows, that hasn't gone away. And if you take a show like Chernobyl, which was a massive success, now it was on Sky Atlantic and HBO in the States, but that was drip fed. That was shown once a week and you had to wait and tune in, or possibly Sky Plus it or whatever it was. So That death is being heralded slightly too early. Like, you think about Brexit or something, people still rush home to see what's happening and they want a live person. So again, I think the death of that may be overstated. It's certainly not all rosy in the garden and there's problems, but that hasn't died either yet.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Whatever way it goes, we're entering a whole new universe in terms of how we watch our screens from the 1st of November. John Fardy, presenter of Screen Time here on News Talk, ready to podcast like ourselves on Fridays. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our six AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.